Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The war of words between the President of the United States and the Supreme Leader of North Korea, the personal name-calling, the threats of obliteration have been so over the top that we are forced to face the possibility of this war of words spilling into actual war, maybe nuclear war, and what that might mean in Korea and far beyond. This hour On Point, Thinking the Unthinkable, a nuclear exchange. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Can we pretend these threats couldn't turn to action? And have we forgotten what nuclear war really means? Join us anytime at On Point Radio or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio or onpointradio.org. We have heard the language, Donald Trump at the United Nations before the General Assembly. This was not in the printed speech, but the prepared speech, but the president delivered it to those assembled there talking about Rocket Man.
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. The United States is ready, willing, and able, but hopefully this will not be necessary. That's what the United Nations is all about. That's what the United Nations is for.
And the President of the United States before the UN talking about the total destruction of North Korea.
The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea.
Joining me first today from Arlington, Virginia, is Michael Crowley, Senior Foreign Affairs Correspondent for Politico. Michael Crowley, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
As we speak today, where does this stand? We've had such an exchange. After that, we had North Korean leader coming back and attacking the President of the United States verbally and calling him a dotard, like a doddering old fool, and deranged. We had Donald Trump saying in a tweet later that, watch out, that means that the U.S. would come back. We've had this threat of a North Korean nuclear test over the Pacific. Where do things stand right now, Michael?
Well, they're in a very troubling and precarious place. And, I think the concern is that what we're seeing here is maybe the, geopolitical equivalent of road rage, where you have two leaders who are blustering, making threats, posturing, trying to show the other one that he is the more dangerous and determined foe. And someone may take an irrational action at this point that they would not take if sort of cooler heads were prevailing, that would lead to a potentially disastrous conflict. And additionally, it's not just bluster or hot-headedness. You also have the possibility of a miscalculation that could be rooted in very legitimate sort of military doctrine. The North Koreans have threatened to shoot down American aircraft off their coast. They did that in 1969 and killed 31 American military personnel. What if an American bomber or spy plane is flying near North Korea and the North Koreans, for instance, were to lock a radar onto it, just as a kind of threat or an intimidation tactic, but we were quite reasonably to strike at the radar or some other North Korean target, and things suddenly spiraled and escalated into a full-fledged conflict. I mean, that's the kind of scenario we're looking at right now quite seriously.
We had U.S. bombers escorted by fighter jets as far north as they've been in many years of the demilitarized zone out to sea, but north of there over the weekend. Is that a kind of warning, a brushback, we can be here, to the North Koreans?
Well, exactly. And I think people might fairly ask, what is that warning really accomplishing? The North Koreans know our capabilities. They know where our planes can fly. So, again, I mean, it's it's brinksmanship and posturing to some degree, and it's a bit of a game of chicken, each side trying to say, you're going to blink first, not us. But the problem is, you know, games of chicken can end in head-on collisions. And let's not forget that the North Koreans have raised the possibility of testing a nuclear device in the atmosphere over the Pacific Ocean, which would be a truly horrifying development. And we don't know how credible that threat is. It's not clear what the U.S. response would be. But, you know, look, we've been talking about North Korea for decades now and its nuclear program, of course, and its hostility going back to the 1950s. I just think there's never been anything quite like this in terms of the level of danger.
Just after midnight on Saturday, President Trump tweeted that the North Korean regime wouldn't be around much longer after their foreign minister, in a speech at the UN, had called Trump mentally deranged. Then North Korea's foreign minister struck back yesterday on a New York sidewalk, talking with reporters through a translator.
Trump claimed our leadership wouldn't be around much longer, and hence, at last, he declared a war on our country. We have every right to take countermeasures, including shooting down U.S. strategic bombers, even when they're not yet inside the airspace border of our country. The question of who won't be around much longer will be answered then.
Ready to shoot down U.S. strategic bombers, even if they're not in the airspace of North Korea. Michael Crowley joins us from Politico. The Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, U.S. Secretary of Defense, was in New Delhi in India today, and here he was at a press conference talking diplomacy, fielding a reporter's question on the risk of war with North Korea.
We maintain the capability to deter North Korea's most dangerous threats, but also to back up our diplomats in a manner that keeps this as long as possible in the diplomatic realm.
As long as possible in the diplomatic realm. But Michael, it's very interesting to hear former NATO Supreme Allied Commander, U.S. Admiral James Stavridis, now Dean of the Tufts Fletcher School. He was talking yesterday about the escalating tensions between Washington and Pyongyang and putting out odds that make armed conflict anyway seem entirely possible.
I would say the chances of an exchange of ordnance are now approaching 50-50.
50-50. And why? This from the former NATO Supreme Commander.
We are at such a high level of potential escalation to full-blown war because of the relative inexperience of the leader in Pyongyang and the leader in Washington.
Michael Crowley, who's steering the ship here? We read that President Trump's words at the UN were not, in the most fiery part, what his advisors were thinking or hoping he would say, that they advised him against attacking Kim Jong-un directly. Who is guiding U.S. policy at the highest level? I guess you've got to say the president, but is he really steering our military posture and policy on North Korea right now?
Well, we just don't know exactly what's happening, but I would say that what appears to be the case is that National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster and Defense Secretary Jim Mattis are probably, and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and some other senior officials like them, are plotting out the kind of formalized, deliberate strategy, thinking through the different scenarios and possibilities, giving recommendations to the president. I think that process is working in a relatively traditional, healthy way. And by the way, you heard Secretary Mattis speaking in very temperate terms, even if he did say, you know, we'll back our diplomats for as long as possible, suggesting it wasn't indefinite. I think the message he was really sending there was a much cooler one, saying that, you know, we really want diplomacy to work here.
But does that matter when the president is saying little rocket man and all the rest, and the North Korean leader's coming back in kind, deranged, doddered?
Right. So, but despite that, you have a president who is taking their counsel and I think in significant ways ignoring it and thinking that he knows how to play a geostrategic game of nuclear chicken better than some of these generals who are advising him. And I think Trump is translating his experience on the campaign trail and in business to the world stage and thinking that through insults and mind games and getting inside this guy's head and showing him that, you know, I'm crazier than he is, he can intimidate him and get him to back down. And it's a really, really risky strategy. And this is a guy with no experience in anything like this kind of a scenario. So I think that many national security policymakers are quite dismayed by the way Donald Trump is approaching this. And the best thing they can hope for is that there is some logic to what's sometimes called the madman theory, that Trump is creating this persona where he's liable to do anything. He's a little bit out of his mind, and that the North Koreans would back down and offer to submit to diplomacy as a result. But so far, there's zero evidence that that is happening.
If it were armed conflict, is the U.S. military present and ready in the Northeast Asia for that now with North Korea?
Well, yes and no. I mean, if we were going to, ideally we would spend weeks building up our forces in the region. If we knew absolutely for sure there was going to be a conflict, we would want to have many more assets positioned there. But over the decades since the Korean War, the U.S. has developed a very substantial military infrastructure in that region, and we could deliver a very punishing blow to North Korea with the help, by the way, of the South Koreans, who have an extremely formidable military. But, you know, when I say those sentences, you have to remember we are talking about hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people being killed in very likely scenarios. There are some unlikely scenarios, I would say, that some people posit in which you might be able to contain a conflict. Maybe you can take out the North Korean regime leadership. Maybe the North Koreans surrender quickly because they know they're guaranteed to be defeated. But it's entirely possible that we are talking about hundreds of thousands or even more people being killed in a conflict like that.
And formidable North Korean forces as well. The fourth largest ground army in the world, 1.2 million soldiers. More tanks than the United States, more artillery pieces than China, and of course nuclear weapons now, and no guarantee that they would not be used. And maybe even if they thought it was a lost cause, maybe to go out and fire. Michael Crowley with Politico, thank you very much for joining us for a moment today.
Thank you, Tom.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are thinking the unthinkable, forced to, thinking about what it would mean if the U.S. and North Korea had some kind of nuclear exchange, nuclear weapons used this hour. You can join us. Can you picture it? Is all the theatrical language pushing toward the possibility of a real fight, even a nuclear fight? And have we forgotten just how terrible a nuclear exchange could be? Again, language, but language can take us places. This was President Trump on Friday in Alabama, campaigning for Republican Senator Luther Strange there, when after North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un, calling him Little Rocket Man, sent him this message.
I'm sure he's listening because he watches every word, and I guarantee you one thing, he's watching us like he never watched anybody before. That I can tell you. And maybe something gets worked out, and maybe it doesn't. Personally, I'm not sure that it will.
Maybe something gets worked out. Maybe it doesn't. Madman theory? Is this an effective strategy here? At the UN General Assembly on Friday, the North Korean Foreign Minister, Ri Yong-ho, unleashed a torrent of insults against President Trump.
The absurd reality that a person like Trump, a mentally deranged person full of megalomania and complacence, the person who is chastised even by American people as Commander in Grief, Lion King, President Evil, is holding the seat of the U.S. President, and the dangerous reality that the gambler who grew old using threats, frauds, and all other schemes to acquire a patch of land holds the nuclear button.
The voice of North Korea there, and U.N. spokesman Stefan Dujarric at a press briefing yesterday warning the U.S. and North Korea about escalating talk of war.
When you have the rise of tension, the rise of rhetoric, so does the risk of miscalculations. Fiery talk can lead to fatal misunderstandings. And I would also reiterate the Secretary General's call for statesmanship.
Joseph Cirincione joins us right now from Washington, president of Plowshares Funded's nonprofit devoted to eliminating the threat of nuclear weapons. Joseph Cirincione, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
It got our attention when we saw James Stavridis, former NATO commander, admiral, saying 50-50 chance of armed conflict. And we're seeing people saying, well, 10% chance of nuclear exchange. Even 10% is not nothing. And once if it went to conventional, who knows where that ends? Right. How are you looking at this right now and the possibility, the risk of it that somehow turning to nuclear war?
I think Admiral Stavridis has got it about right. I would put the risk of nuclear war higher. I don't think there'd be a fire break once the fighting started. So if it goes conventional, I think one side or the other was going to be very likely to use nuclear weapons, either the ones on the missiles that Kim Jong-un has. We think he might have as many as 20 that he could put on a short or medium-range missile that could hit South Korea or Japan, possibly on a long-range missile that could hit the west coast of the United States. And, of course, we have thousands of weapons of various kinds, even so-called mini-nukes that could be used for limited attacks. So I'm very worried about this scenario. I think we're closer to an intentional nuclear war than at any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Stavridis saying the same thing, and that's a long time. You know, intentional is the word you use, but these things can also escalate. I mean, once you somebody bumps somebody else and somebody fires back, and pretty soon here we go.
Well, I think that's exactly the scenario we're all worried about. And when I say we, I'm part of a large network of nuclear security experts and Korea experts, Asia hands, and we exchange information on listservs. I've never seen the concern this high before. Everybody is worried. It got so bad that one of the leading expert sites, something called 38 North, put out an editorial yesterday on their website saying, take a deep breath, and trying to get us all to calm down, that there might be some signs that, that negotiations could get started. But frankly, just as Michael Crowley was saying, we have two inexperienced, impulsive leaders playing a game of nuclear chicken in the most heavily militarized area on Earth. It's not at all clear that anybody in either of those leader circles are able to restrain them, that the rhetoric might get carried away. And that's the risk, that as the rhetoric escalates, something happens, maybe accidental, maybe a miscalculation, that then escalates out of control, and we will have the largest, at least conventional war that the world has seen since the end of World War II.
Don't imagine Rob Givens telling the LA Times here, this is a retired Air Force Brigadier General, spent 4 years on the Korean Peninsula, says, don't imagine this would be like Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya or Syria. There's a very large North Korean military, and with now, in one form or another, nuclear weapons. I mean, just the conventional, 11,000 conventional artillery pieces dug into those mountains north of Seoul. They're talking about maybe a couple of million people could die in a very short period of time just from that.
Yes.
If this went nuclear, what are the scenarios, as horrible as they are to contemplate, how would that emerge?
Well, let's do a couple of them. First, with the conventional. There are some thoughts that, you know, the U.S. could strike first and do a massive attack on those mountains overlooking Seoul. Remember, Seoul has 25 million people. Mm-hmm. It sprawls right up to the demilitarized zone.
Yep.
And over those mountains that the North Koreans have dug in artillery and tubes, they are capable of putting, for example, 5,000 artillery shells on Seoul within 10 minutes. And then doing it again and doing it again and doing it again. So estimates are that hundreds of thousands of South Koreans would die in the first few hours. One scenario is that they would do a limited barrage to signal their seriousness and then stop and tell the U.S. to back off. Would the U.S. back off? It's impossible to take those shells, those artillery tubes out with conventional weapons. You just can't
They're
do
deep
it.
Deep tunnels there. They move them in and out to fire.
Exactly. Well, what about nuclear weapons? We have nuclear weapons that can be sort of dialed back to relatively low yields, like smaller than the bombs we used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Could you use those? There are some who are advocating this, who say, let's go use that. So that's
some inside the military, inside the government?
Not inside. Mm-hmm. Not okay. inside. You, okay. But you're getting, these circles of people that are encouraged. People like Duncan Hunter, a congressman in the House Armed Services Committee, mm-hmm. is arguing for a preemptive strike. Hit him now. But he hasn't raised the nuclear issue yet. There's another likely nuclear exchange scenario. He's threatened just last week. The foreign minister of North Korea, Mr. Ri, has said we might launch a hydrogen bomb, put a hydrogen bomb on our missile to show you we can do it. Think we can't do this?
This is the and test then, over the Pacific that he was talking
yes.
about.
And then it would land somewhere in the South Pacific. Well, let's say that works, and there's all kinds of reasons why it might not work, mm-hmm. but let's say it works. And then you have the first hydrogen bomb in the atmosphere since 1980. Last mushroom cloud anybody in the world has seen mm-hmm. was the Chinese test in 1980. This would have a huge psychological impact on the world to see this. And people would be terrified. What's the president of the United States going to do? He might decide, that's it. We got to go. He could order a U.S. nuclear strike. And remember, the president and the president alone has the authority to launch U.S. nuclear weapons. And once he gives the order, no one could stop him. He could be on the golf course in New Jersey and order a limited strike, and the missiles would take off 4 minutes after he gave the order. He's not required to consult with the Congress or the Secretary of Defense or even the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He could just do it. So that's the kind of scenario. It's all these – it's not just that the North Koreans are agitating or making these threats. We've seen this before. The two things that are different is, one, they have a long-range missile that can hit the United States. They've tested it twice. Two, they have a hydrogen bomb, a hugely destructive instrument of death. And three, we have President Trump.
We've got 35,000 U.S. troops on the Korean Peninsula, U.S. troops there.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, lots of other locations. Does North Korea really have the capacity to deliver with anything like accuracy anywhere?
Deliver
nuclear
what?
A nuclear strike?
Yes. Yes.
How?
So
I mean, they barely use these missiles. They've tested them, but
well,
it's a whole different thing when you load
missiles.
The bomb on and you've got to get it where it's going.
They have about 1,000 short and medium range missiles. These are the Nodungs, and they've tested them a lot. They're quite reliable. They're fairly accurate. We've seen their performance. They could put a nuclear – we believe they're capable of putting a nuclear weapon on those, and those could hit Seoul or Japan. The longer-range ones are more risky. You're absolutely right. Would they risk putting a hydrogen bomb on a missile they've only tested two or three times? We wouldn't, but people have. Back in the 1960s, when the Chinese were just getting their nuclear bombs, and they did their first test in 64, the U.S. was downplaying their capability. So the Chinese put a nuclear weapon on a missile and fired it within China. Very risky, but it worked. It exploded. And that was the end of anybody questioning the U.S., the Chinese nuclear deterrent. The North Koreans may be watching and thinking about that test.
We had Brigadier General Givens saying, again, he spent 4 years on the Korean Peninsula. He said, in an all-out conquest or contest for regime survival, they will come after the United States. They're not going to win, but they will try. I guarantee that, the U.S. Brigadier General is saying. And he said they might not have to deliver it by missile. He said, well, what about smuggling it into a container port or dropping it from an airplane somewhere near a U.S. base in Asia?
Well, that is an excellent point. We focus on the missiles, and there's all this talk about shooting them down. By the way, we can't shoot them down. We don't have the capability to shoot them down.
What about THAAD and all of that?
All of those are too short a range. Those are short-range systems. Mm-hmm. They do pretty well in tests, but they've been very simple tests. THAAD has never been tested against more than two targets, for example. Mm-hmm. Well, what's it going to do when there's 10, 20, 100 missiles coming? Forget it. And the long-range system we have in Alaska that's supposed to be capable of defending against this, the so-called ground-based missile defense system, at least half the interceptors are known to have manufacturing flaws in them that mean they don't work. And they've only been tested under perfect conditions. And even there, in the test, they only hit 5 out of 10 times. They only have a 50% success rate, and that's against perfect targets. If North Korea is going to launch a missile at the United States, it's not going to give us a perfect target. It's going to have decoys, chaff, jammers. Mm. Yep. It's going to try to knock out the defense's radars, etc. So forget it. Don't think that we can defend against even a simple North Korean missile. One of the dangers here is that North Korea doesn't use a missile. You know, they have a hydrogen bomb now. This is a something that could be 10, 20, 50 times the size of a Hiroshima bomb, a huge fireball. Mm-hmm. You don't have to deliver that by missile. You could bring it by boat. You don't have to worry about getting it through customs. You blow up customs. You blow up the boat when it's in the harbor. You could send it by an aircraft. You could FedEx it. I mean, what exactly is going to stop this thing from coming to the United States? You could smuggle it by truck over the Mexican or Canadian border. This is the real nightmare scenario. Don't think conventionally with the North Koreans, because they don't. And don't forget about cyber attacks. They have some of the most gifted cyber armies in the world. So you could see all these different kinds of threats coming from North Korea, which is exactly why President Trump's top national security advisors told him not to taunt Kim Jong-un. Don't personally attack him in his UN speech. We know that now. The LA Times has reported, the New York Times has said, don't do it. It wasn't in the speech on Monday. He stuck it in on Tuesday, and here we go.
Joseph Cirincione is with us from Washington, the Plowshares Fund. So many questions here. You talked about going after the artillery north of Seoul with the dialed-back American nukes, but what about the radiation consequences, that the fallout consequences for everybody, including our allies, the South Koreans, and U.S. troops there?
Oh, absolutely. Remember, the tests we've been conducting, even the North Korean tests, have been underground. North Korea is under no obligation to do that, but even it shows you the power of the international norm. They've been conducting it underground in part to contain the radiation. They don't want to piss off the Chinese with a flow of radiation coming out of a test. But if you're using nuclear weapons, even limited numbers, in North Korea, there is going to be substantial radiation, the dirt, the dust, the smoke, the particulates, and that is going to spread most immediately to the countries involved, but eventually around the world. And if you have a very large detonation, for example, if they did detonate a hydrogen bomb in the Pacific, well, we know what happens to that. We detonated 100 hydrogen bombs in the South Pacific, and the radiation spread around the world. It was easily detectable in dozens and dozens of countries. That's one of the reasons that the United States, under President Kennedy, negotiated what they called the Limited Test Ban Treaty in 1963, and the Soviets and the U.S. stopped their above-ground tests. Others followed more or less, France, etc., and China conducted the last one in 1980.
Before the UN, the President of the United States threatened the total destruction of North Korea. Do we have to presume that that means he's thinking nuclear? And what would that mean?
I think he's almost certainly thinking nuclear, but don't forget, actually most Americans don't know, that we already totally destroyed North Korea.
In the Korean War. I mean, there was destruction right up and down that peninsula, fought to a draw, never had a real peace agreement at all, just a truce. But the question stands, what would that mean? In nuclear terms, if that's what he means.
You could we have this is funny to tell people, but the President of the United States is followed around at all times by a military officer. He carries what's called the nuclear football. In the nuclear football is the ability to communicate to the military command authority, it's called the military command center, and order a nuclear strike. And that in the football, he has a binder. People describe it as kind of a Chinese menu of nuclear options, and you can do various things. You want to launch all our nuclear weapons? Okay. How about some? And there's limited strike options on Korea. So we've already planned this out. This has been planned. This has been practiced. So the president could order ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, to target Pyongyang, major cities, the ports, the facilities, the entire country. He could go somewhere between two or three, up to you know, three or four dozen. That would totally destroy North Korea.
Okay, we're also in the realm of madness, but what would the consequences be for South Korea, for Japan, our allies, for the U.S., the U.S. troops?
You would bring the South Korean, at least the economy, to a screeching halt. that's the 11th largest economy in the world. So you would have immediate economic dislocation, probably triggering at least a global recession. And there's no guarantee, by the way, that even after this attack that everybody's dead. There would be some left. Would you get all the weapons? You might not. North Korea could still have some to retaliate, and they most certainly would fire them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are thinking the unthinkable this hour, forced to by circumstances, thinking about what it would might mean if the U.S. and North Korea had some kind of nuclear exchange. Joseph Cerincione is with us, president of Plowshares Fund. It's a nonprofit devoted to eliminating the threat of nuclear weapons, author of Nuclear Nightmares. You can join us as well. Does this all seem unreal? Can we assume it will stay that way? Are you sickened to have to teach these implications to a new generation in 2017? In Alabama, on Friday, President Trump worked up the crowd with tough talk on North Korea and its leader, Kim Jong-un.
He may be smart, he may be strategic, and he may be totally crazy. But you know what? No matter what he is, we're going to handle it, folks. Believe me, we're going to handle it.
And here, the North Korean foreign minister speaking to reporters in New York yesterday, saying the American president's insults, he said, make a nuclear strike on the American mainland more likely.
Due to his lacking of basic common knowledge and proper sentiment, he tried to insult the supreme dignity of my country by referring it to a rocket. By doing so, however, he committed an irreversible mistake of making our rocket's visit to the entire U.S. mainland inevitable all the more.
North Korea's foreign minister, Joseph Cerincione, please stand by. Alan Robach joins us now from Piscataway, New Jersey, distinguished professor of climate science at Rutgers, expert on the effects of nuclear strikes on the planet. He published an open letter to the president-elect, Donald Trump, on nuclear weapons and nuclear winter, published in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, republished in January at the Huffington Post. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Alan Robach, Professor Robach, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
And we know you've looked at the possibility in a major exchange back in the day between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, let's say, of a global nuclear winter where crops are fail because of the implications of a huge exchange. What about the scale of exchange that in our nightmares could be seen between the U.S. and North Korea? What are the implications?
Nuclear winter would be produced by fires that would be started in cities and industrial areas, and the smoke would go up in the atmosphere, blocking the sun, making it cold and dark at the Earth's surface. The amount of smoke is what causes the climate change, and so we would have to look at a scenario of what would the targets be, how much smoke would be generated.
But there you're talking about a major exchange and lots going into the atmosphere and billions, I think is your estimate, 1 or 2 billion dying of starvation ultimately because of crops that don't come. But that's a superpower exchange. What about a U.S.-North Korea exchange?
No, the U.S. and Russia could still produce a nuclear winter, killing most of the people on the planet. But we looked at a war between India and Pakistan using much less than 1% of the current global nuclear arsenal, and that could still kill 1 billion or 2 billion people because of the climate change.
So, Professor, I'm trying to get you to focus on the Korean Peninsula and the imminent, sadly, threat we're looking at there.
No, I understand. So if we destroyed every city in North Korea, it might produce maybe 1/10 of the amount of smoke of an India-Pakistan exchange. Mm-hmm. But then we have to take into consideration, would Seoul burn? Would Tokyo burn? And the greatest threat, I think, is what if U.S. missiles were flying over China and Russia toward North Korea? Would the Chinese and Russians believe that that was not a ruse to attack them? Would they get involved? What if a few went off target? So this really has the potential to escalate into something much worse.
When you talk about smoke, this isn't smoke ultimately that just gets blown away. You're talking about in a nuclear exchange, particulate that goes so high in the atmosphere that it just kind of forms an umbrella over the Earth, if I've got it right.
Yeah, you would get a firestorm. The cities would burn. And unfortunately, we have examples of that happening. In 1906 in San Francisco, an earthquake produced a fire that burned for 3 days. And Jack London wrote about it. He said the fire burned the winds were so strong, so enormous was the suck. The fire burned a colossal chimney through the atmosphere. And so this firestorm would pump the smoke up into the stratosphere where there's no rain to wash it out, and it would be blown around the world and last for years. We even have examples of a few forest fires that have done that recently.
So you can really get into changing much more than the devastating changes that can happen right on the ground, and you can go there in a hurry. Mary Jo is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Mary Jo, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm just calling to find out if anyone has any idea how to get this to stop. Mm-hmm. I remember the Bay of Pigs. I remember Vietnam. And this is the most frightened I have been. And people my age are sitting there going, I can't believe I've lived this long and I'm having to look at this now. And I'm just wondering if there is anything anyone can imagine that would get the president to stop.
Well, I mean, you've got the Secretary of Defense at his right hand there talking diplomacy all the time. But Joseph Rincione, what about the breaks here?
Yeah.
The really effective breaks. Where do you see them?
There's two things. First of all, if you're frightened by what you're hearing, you're reacting appropriately. This is not a game. We're not kidding around here. This is, I think, in some ways much more serious than people realize. We're distracted by so much else that's going on. Number, there are two paths here. One is just with the U.S. North Korean contingency, stop pouring gasoline on the fire. Stop it, Mr. President. Don't provoke him anymore. Don't do this kind of talk. Back off. Just be quiet. No tweets, no insults. Pull it back a little bit. Second, get close to China and South Korea, our two closest sort of allies or at least partners in this issue, and start to explore ways to have a dialogue with North Korea at a minimum to reduce the possibility of miscalculation, which is what our biggest worry is, and to see if possible that we could start some kind of negotiations that could get a freeze in the North Korean program in exchange for a freeze in some of our military exercises. But there's a whole other path, and members of Congress are now starting to discuss that. We should talk about restricting the ability of the President of the United States to unilaterally launch a nuclear war, to make the most fateful decision we can make in government that is now done completely undemocratically. So you have members like Ed Markey and Ted Lieu who have introduced legislation to prevent the President from launching a nuclear weapon first without consulting Congress. You have Senator Bob Corker at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, a Republican, talking about holding hearings on the President's ability. You have people who are about to introduce legislation later this week prohibiting the President from going to war in North Korea without, guess what, a congressional authorization of war. The Congress should do what the Constitution demands it to do, take a role in whether we go to war or not. This is not something to be left up to a nuclear monarch.
David in Tampa, Florida. David, thank you for calling.
Hey, Tom. Being an in-country Vietnam vet, I'm the last guy that wants to see any war.
Mm-hmm.
But over the last 4 or 5 decades, we've dealt with this guy's grandfather and his father and now him. We've made agreements, signed documents, all that, and they've lied and broken every agreement.
Mm.
So it takes two to tango. How does anybody get this guy to go along with anything that is proposed by us, China, Russia, or anybody else? Thank you.
What do you think of the way the president's going then with it, David?
Whatever has been done by the previous presidents hasn't worked. So maybe calling this guy out will get his attention in a way that that could possibly make him realize that he's got some mortal danger here.
Yeah.
Nobody else has done that.
David, I appreciate your call. Joe, what about it? I mean, we heard Michael Crowley talk about the madman theory at the top, sort of scare the daylights out of them by talking tough or even wildly. How does that work out strategically?
This was invented by Richard Nixon about 8 months into his presidency, actually, in 1969. He was so frustrated by the failure to get the North Vietnamese to stop the war that he launched nuclear armed bombers towards the Soviet border, had them circle the pole. And the point was to make the Russians think that he was so crazy that he might do anything, and they in turn would lean on North Vietnam and force them to give in. Didn't work. You can think that President Trump is trying something similar here, acting like this, acting crazy in order to get China to lean on North Korea. Two things. So far, it's not working. The Chinese do want to rein in North Korea, but they want there to be a negotiation. What's the way out? You can't just make North Korea collapse. You can't just crush them. There has to be a negotiated solution. That part of the strategy is missing so far. And the second, this might not be an act. This might not be
on the president's
plan,
part,
like Richard Nixon had. This may be just what he is. After all, this kind of strategy has worked for the president in his business and in his political career. It got him into the White House. As Michael Crowley was saying, he's just doing what he thinks is successful. But in this case, he's going up against a nuclear-armed bully with his own strategy.
Bluster up. Richard in Midland, Texas. Richard, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hey, Tom.
Yes, sir.
I'm concerned about the economic impact of any conflict in Korea. If Seoul gets destroyed, there goes Samsung, there goes LG, there goes the Foxconn plant that they plan to build in Wisconsin. This could lead to a 10-year, 20-year depression. Is that going to be Trump's legacy?
Richard, I appreciate your call. Alan Robach, what about the economic consequences? Of course, if there were direct hits on factories, I mean, Joe Cirincione says you could set the global economy back, but you're talking about an environmental price here as well, Alan.
Yes, if there was enough smoke from the fires, it could cool the earth enough that agriculture would fail around the world, and that would produce a terrible problem. In 2011, there was a drought in Russia, and they stopped exporting wheat. The price of food doubled, and that led to the Arab Spring. So small changes in the price of food around the world could produce problems far removed from where the conflict would take place.
I think there's no doubt. And of course, that produces an environmental and an economic impact. You know, for some Americans, this is not distant at all. In Hawaii, they had hearings last week, public hearings, about how to prepare for a nuclear strike. And here was Major General Joe Logan. He's Hawaii's Emergency Management Director and State Adjutant General at those public hearings.
First responders in the community is all of you. The police, the fire, the ambulance workers in the communities are all busy trying to do the critical infrastructure to get the roads open. Yes, the guard is coming. Yes, the law enforcement, the first responders are coming. But we may not get there immediately. And so if you take care of yourselves and your communities, it would be less work for everyone else.
Scenario planning in Hawaii. Courtney Teague joins us right now from Honolulu. She covers Hawaii state politics for the online journal Honolulu Civil Beat. Courtney, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
What's the conversation in Hawaii about this threat? Is it being taken seriously? Does it sound very hypothetical to Hawaiians?
Yeah, so it's interesting. At the public hearing that you just played the audio from, you know, there's like a million people on Oahu, right? And maybe 40 of them showed up to the state capitol to be prepped on this. So of the people that did show up, they were definitely upset that we don't have any nuclear fallout shelters, no infrastructure in place to deal with something like this. But for the most part, it's maybe something that people are a little anxious about, but it's not really a topic of daily conversation.
You get maybe 20 minutes warning, people were told at that hearing. Is there a feeling that, well, you can't really prepare for it? If it happens, it happens.
Yeah, I think certainly some people feel that way, but state officials are really, they're repeating the mantra, get inside, stay tuned. They're trying to teach people to prepare for something like this. Lawmakers, for example, in a private hearing earlier in the week, it asked state officials, what can we learn from South Korea, other countries that are facing threats like this all the time? Officials said they don't live in constant fear because they've incorporated this knowledge of preparing for a nuclear attack into their everyday lives. So it's a matter of when you're on your morning commute, where would you pull over if you had 5 minutes to get inside, that kind of thing.
You had State Rep. Gene Ward there, Republican, saying, don't want to worry the public, but he said now's the time to take it seriously, not to be alarmist, but to be informing people. Joe Cerencioni,
take us out of this.
Yeah, take us out of this. And I don't know how. We're still in the escalating rhetoric phase of this.
Right.
But that can go fast.
We're not powerless here. You know, this is not a monarchy. We don't have to just sit back and just watch what our leaders are doing. We can get involved. I know there's a lot of stuff going on, but the Congress should be having hearings on this, should be talking about the congressional role. Remember, the Constitution gives the Congress the power to declare war. They should be getting much more involved at this in this port. The mass movement that has erupted since the Trump presidency should be starting to get involved. Yes, there are pressing domestic issues, but this is an issue that could trump all of our domestic issues if it goes into the worst case scenario. And right now, every step we're taking is bringing us closer to war. In the last few weeks, there hasn't been one step taken in the other direction. We've got to get our political leaders to move the other way.
But there's the North Korean nuclear program as well, and the threats coming out of Pyongyang. I mean, the Americans look at that and worry
as
well.
Yes, this can be fixed. This can be fixed. Remember, negotiations have worked before. In fact, it's the only thing that worked, going back to one of your previous callers. We froze the North Korean program for 8 years, starting in 1994. They didn't build a single bomb. If we hadn't done that, they would have had 100 nuclear bombs by now. We froze the missile program for 8 years due to negotiations. We almost had a deal in 2000 to make that freeze permanent, to roll back the whole program. But unfortunately, President Bush came in with a different strategy, a different plan, a regime change plan, an axis of evil plan. We walked away from the deal, not North Korea. That's one of the big reasons we're faced with this crisis right now. We gave up on negotiations when we should have doubled down.
Ellen Robach, in a word, do you think the U.S. government understands the potential environmental implications of any nuclear exchange?
No, I don't. We've done a lot of research on this, and we don't have any evidence that they're paying attention. I talked to President Obama's nuclear advisor, and they really weren't interested.
And here we are. An education today, too much to think about right there. Ellen Robach at Rutgers University, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Courtney Teague at Honolulu Civil Beat in Honolulu, thank you very much for joining us, Courtney.
Thank you.
And Joseph Cerencioni at Plowshares Fund in Washington. Thank you, Joe.
My pleasure, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.